Welcome to Life Unleashed. I'm Sarah Hodgson, author, dog trainer, and behavior expert.
Join me with special guest Michael Shikashio, where we discuss why dogs bite people.
Hey, it's Sarah. I'm here with another episode of Life Unleashed. In this episode, we are diving deep into why dogs bite people. And I have a very special guest. I'm so excited to be introducing Michael Shikashio. Michael is an internationally recognized figure who has dedicated his work to the topic of dog aggression. He is the founder of the Aggression in Dogs Master Course, which I'm taking, and is currently teaching trainers and behavior consultants in more than 25 countries worldwide. Michael, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Sarah. I'm excited to be here.
I remember I first met Michael about 12 or 13 years ago at a Karen Pryor conference, and I hadn't really been indoctrinated to your line of thinking, but I did know you were focusing all your energy and your passion on really getting a deeper understanding of dog aggression. And at that time, people still considered dogs who were showing aggression as bad dogs. And many of them were being euthanized, and no one was really looking at aggression as simply a mood state, you know, a reaction to feeling unsafe. And I clearly remember that day because you really spotlighted aggression is just one resource a dog will use to protect themselves. I find in my work, as I'm sure you do in yours, that whether it's clients or people you meet at a party, they're very, very embarrassed and discouraged when their dog bites them, bites a friend, bites their child. And when I kind of explain aggression as you understand it as well, and as you've influenced my thinking, it just makes sense. And the person doesn't feel as shameful or embarrassed or frustrated with their dog. So I thought a good topic to open up, and I do know it's a loaded question, is why do dogs choose to bite people?
Yeah, it's a great question because aggression, as you said, has a lot of stigma to it, right? It's like a kind of quote unquote bad thing. But actually, for me, it's a normal thing. If we didn't have aggressive behaviors in our repertoire, we wouldn't be able to avoid threats or stay safe. And so to for our own survival, you know, as any species has to have some level of aggressive behavior to keep threats away or to keep access to resources. So humans are no different, right? We display aggression when we want to protect ourselves. If somebody comes up to our child or to jumps into our property or tries to break down our door, it's the same thing as for a dog to, you know, bark at the strange guy coming through the front door. It's like if somebody comes through our front door, like, who is that? Right. Unfortunately, dogs don't always know if they're invited or not. So, <Right. laughs> you know, and some of them think everybody's not invited. And so we have to remember that aggression is a very normal thing for animals and humans to keep themselves safe, as well as, you know, maintain access to resources or things of value. And again, people do that as well. So,
Right. I find one thing I tell my clients is if your dog had their choice, no one would come into your den. Your den is, you know, a very sacred place. It's where a dog would gather with those they know, those are comfortable. And like you said, if a stranger just walked into our home, we would have a reaction to that. I was listening to one of the lectures on your site, and I remember they were looking at the two types of aggression. And then I also found this discussed in your master course. And I'm wondering if you can talk about it a little before we, you know, dive into the belly of situations that would cause a dog to bite. And that's the two types of aggression are proactive and reactive aggression. And, you know, as in all the dog lingo and terminology, sometimes it's hard to grasp and remember that until you've really heard it several times. So could you kind of bring up how you determine if a dog is proactive in their use of aggression or reactive?
Yeah, another great question. I think it's important to understand the differences when we're using certain terminology. So proactive versus reactive is some, you might often hear that interchanged with offensive versus defensive aggression as well. And for me, it matters sometimes, doesn't matter all the time when we're looking at that, but it's because the dog, I think most importantly, we should know what the antecedent or what is the trigger in the environment, why the dog feels they need to be display that aggression. But we might define proactive aggression as the dog taking steps to deal with a particular threatening stimulus before that actual stimulus presents the typical trigger, right? So let's use an example. The dog has been frightened by children before. And so like maybe some child did something bad or threw a rock at the dog or did something scary, maybe not even on purpose.
Or even just kiss them or hug them.
Yeah, something that the dog perceived as a threat. So and then maybe that's happened a couple times. So after a few weeks go by, the dog's like maybe growled at a child and, you know, everybody's like, oh, better make sure. So everybody learns to stay away from the dog. But then maybe a child is riding by the house on a bike, you know, and so the dog then will proactively leave their property to go chase that child to make that child go away. Even if the child's going to go away anyways, they're just riding by the house. But the dog's like, ooh, you're a threat to me, and you could potentially be a threat to me.
You're a threat to my territory.
Yeah. I'm going to deal with that now before you actually do anything threatening to me. So that's where it can be seem like it happens. You get those sort of quotes, you know, it happened out of the blue, or, you know, or he's like trying to eat the child, or, you know, you get all these interesting statements about the situation. But that's it's often the dog just being proactive about it, just like we would. Right. And so the same thing for defensive or reactive aggression is when the dog is responding to this triggering stimulus in the environment. So that threat is actually already. So it's that child running towards the dog, reaching, and the dog doesn't respond until that child or threat has breached their critical distance. So that distance around them in which the dog feels at a point where they no longer have safety, meaning they feel like this is an imminent threat. Now I have to react. So they bite as the child's reaching or while the child actually is touching them. And so that's more of the reactive slash defensive aggression that we might define. Those kind of the general differences. And there's some arguments that I've seen arguments where like neither of those exist. It's just aggressive behavior reacting to a particular stimulus in the environment, particular environmental conditions. And that makes sense as well. But I do think from understanding why a dog might be displaying aggression in a certain way or a certain context, it's helpful to discuss those concepts as well.
One thing I heard in another lecture you gave or as part of the Dog Masters series is that the emotion that leads to a bite is either the dog is excessively frustrated or the dog is excessively fearful, and that causes that rise in adrenaline, that sympathetic fight or flight nervous system to jump, which again, the dog is not thinking, I don't like this person, or it's a hostile takeover. It's just reacting to that leap in adrenaline that makes them feel unsafe or makes them feel intensely frustrated. And often, I don't know how often you see this. I'd love a percentage, if one exists, of the dogs that bite and then actually are confused as to what just happened. I always say, what happens after the bite? And the person is like, the dog looks remorseful, or the dog looks like they're in shock, or they didn't understand what just happened.
So yeah, that's an interesting question, because I think it depends on a lot of factors. So what the client might be seeing may not necessarily be what the dog is experiencing, right? So they might see physiological signs that the dog's in a daze, what they would say is the dog's in a daze, or the dog seemed remorseful, or the dog seemed like they felt guilty about it.
They knew they did something wrong.
Right. And, you know, it's often just a result of the physiological responses to highly stressing situations. So you might see dilated pupils or pyloerection, so the hackles being up, or, you know, the dog excessively breathing, or excessive respiration, or increases in heart rate. Those things will present physiological signs where it looks like the dog's kind of like in a daze or like shocked, or and that might be the case in some examples. Maybe the dog does have some neurological disorders. Partial seizures can result in some biting situations, but those are rare. Typically, the dog knows exactly what they did, in the sense of how we know that is we can see other behaviors. We can cue other behaviors. They're in a cognitive state, meaning they're not just like, I'm shocked, I can't, I've lost like all touch with reality. It's like you can cue another behavior and the dog will go right to that, which says they're thinking, they're aware of the environment. It's just the stress signals that we might see that can look like that. And then, of course, the dog might work to avoid the stimulus. So just like, remember those guilty dog videos that were really floating around YouTube like a few years ago? Just, you know, ridiculous videos, people like saying, oh, my dog's guilty. They know they were bad getting in the trash or something like that. Yeah, it was awful. This awful like trend at the time. But, you know, the dog, people would think their dog felt guilty or remorseful, but it's actually the dog just responding to our body language and our communication, right? So it's the dog seeing what might predict punishment or what might predict an unsavory situation based on our facial expression.
Right.
Like
or
they've seen
bodies.
That face. Right. Yeah, they've seen our body language that might predict something bad is going to happen because it has in the past. And that's why they look remorseful. So certainly when a dog tries to bite somebody or air snaps, the person's not going to be happy most of the time. It's the dog's going to see that, and that's why it looks like it's remorseful or, you know,
it's
sad.
It's funny how we can't get that those words out of the lexicon, like the dominant, they're trying to dominate, they felt guilty. You know, I always try to explain to people that the dog's brain, the actual organ that fills up our head, occupies, you know, less than 50% of their head. Their head is like 80% sensory neurons. They're attuned to interpreting sensory input versus contemplate the past, present, future, who's thinking, you know, they physically can't go there. They don't have the mechanism. And it's funny because people say they're in a daze and I'm like, well, how did you respond? And they're like, we yelled, we pulled the dog away, you know, we smacked the dog or whatever. And I do think you're correct. One thing you said a minute ago, and I've never really thought of this question, and you, of course, would probably know the answer, but when a dog is showing resources, protecting resources, whether it's a place on the couch, sleep, or food, or a bone, or a toy, the jump from feeling safe and content with that object to feeling threatened can be a very quick reaction, like 0 to 60. And then you generally don't see the hackles go up. And yet when a dog is at the window barking at somebody going by, or they're in the front yard or on the porch, the hackles do go up. And I remember long ago it was perceived that this was always a sign of aggression. And I find it's as often a sign of just feeling anxious in the situation or feeling threatened when playing with another dog and the dog kind of gets hyperstimulated. So can you talk on the reasons why a dog's hackles may go up and why it doesn't often happen, or it's not as often seen in situations where the dog is reacting aggressively due to its resources being threatened?
Yeah, I think it's a two-part answer here. So the first part we're thinking we should consider looking at is the arousal. So the dog's arousal level, the dog's response to stimuli in the environment that will increase or decrease the arousal level. So arousal, just loosely defined, is it's not always a bad thing. It's just this sort of awareness of the environment. So the moment we wake up in the morning, we're in a state of arousal, right? So we're aware of what's going on.
We're awake.
Right. And then our brain and our body starts to recognize things. So like after we have that first cup of coffee, right, we're in a more premium state of arousal, not a bad thing. So arousal isn't a bad word. Sometimes it's thought of as a bad thing in dogs, but it's actually, we use it sometimes to our advantage with like dog sports or something like that. We like dogs in a high state of arousal because they're ready to go. They've had that first cup of coffee. They're thinking, well, they're able to type of email without making many mistakes, right? Like us. But then you get into negative states of arousal when we get over aroused. We have that second cup of coffee. We are wired. We're like
hyper.
We're like just, you know, just went to a dance party or so, whatever. We're just right. And then we start to perform less well. So our cognitive abilities are impaired. And so that's where arousal could be an issue when you start to get into those negative states, those over arousal, your performance diminishes. And so that's why we might see it in aggression cases where a dog sees something at a distance. Let's say we'll use that reactive dog on the porch. They're on their porch, they see another dog coming. You start to see that arousal spike. And they kind of have a little more time for that arousal to build up. So I use this example all the time. It's like the Jaws theme music. You can see something coming from a distance. And then it starts to build. So you can, like, just like people, you can imagine how your arousal would build if you saw like a scary person coming down the street with a gun towards your house, right? Versus if you're in your house and somebody suddenly springs through the door with that gun, you're not expecting it. You might not have time for those hairs on the back of your neck to go up, right? So that's where you see more of you can often see a very intense response in either situation, but you're going to see more of a rapid, intense response, of course, when it's more startling and there hasn't been that ramp up anxiety. So I think that's part of it. Then also the dog's learning history. So let's say you have a history of that person walking down the street with a gun and you know they're going to be breaking into your house. That presents more anxiety because you're expecting it. You've learned that person's a bad thing versus, you know, again, a one-time incident where somebody breaks through your home may not be as likely for all your hackles to go up and all those things versus if you're expecting it 3 o'clock every day, somebody's coming, going to break through your door right around 2:55. Your arousal level is going to start to spike. Your adrenaline is going to go up and all those things that because of the learning history there. So it's part learning and part, physiological responses. And so when you see all that, we have to think about like just how much is the physiological response is going to play out in that animal. Just like people, right? Like some people, like if I was to jump up behind you and scare you suddenly, startle or throw a fake snake, you know, on your lap while you're sitting there and not expecting it, your response is going to be different than pretty much everybody else, and like everybody's response can be slightly different. Some people might scream, some people might laugh, some people might not even care, right? And so those are the physiological responses. Your pupils might get dilated, your heart rate might go up, you might start to sweat. Those are the non-voluntary physiological responses we can see. Same thing with dogs, right? Piloerection, increased heart rate. Those are things the dog can't necessarily control. Dilated pupils, excessive salivation, you know, from sweat through the paw pads. All those things give us the indication about, you know, kind of the broader answer to your question there, which is like, why are those physiological responses there too? So
it makes so much more sense when you relate your animal nature to another species, whether it's a cat, certainly a dog. Now you spoke of something, or you're speaking of something that kind of triggers a term I often use with clients. And that is, aggression is most often a response to fear, or I say aggression is a bodyguard of fear. And fear, anxiety are interchangeable in that context to me, that many dogs are simply aggressive because they have no other choice. So I'm working with a woman right now. She has two Boston Terriers. She goes to our church. She's come in. She pulls up her leg, and there's this massive wound. She pulls up her sleeve, massive wound. The dog is just entering that emotional and sexual maturity of 2 years old. And in talking to her, it's displaced aggression. She's picking the dog up when it's barking at the UPS man. Non-intentionally, she's the most loving, wonderful, giving human, but like literally airlifting the dog to get it from attacking another dog, in which it kind of spins around and attacks her. And I've been there a couple of times and explained, like no one had ever explained the nature of a dog in a way she could possibly comprehend. Somebody had brought an e-collar, they hadn't used it. So we're working with the dog, and it reacts very aggressively, biting at the window whenever the lawn people are there. And the first thing I said is, how much is this dog sleeping? a day. And I always explain to people, dogs have a more crepuscular nature. They're most awake at dawn and dusk. And if their viewpoint is that they're border patrol, they're going to be reactive and you don't even know what emotion's under it. So after a couple weeks of giving the dog a couple of naps a day, play training, so the leash being put on doesn't cue a reactive nature, you know, just playing on the property and in the house, I went over just before our session. And when the lawn people that were next door turned on their mowers, the dog actually started to shake. And when we brought the dog down to the street, it was on high alert, just like you're saying. I know a dog's going to come. It wasn't referencing its person. It was pulling on the leash. We did, I call them walking squares or quick turnabouts. I do this little game with dogs when they're on a leash. I call it scurry scurry, where I'll run really fast and then throw a hot dog down and say, find it. And then they love scurry scurry. I used to do this with my kids, and now they just like are so embarrassed when I say scurry scurry. But I find it's very effective to click a dog into a playful nature when you need to pass. We talked about space and time. But what was fascinating to me, and you know, I want your feedback there, is it's actually, even the dog was very aggressive and biting, displaced aggression because it couldn't get away. The dog was actually very afraid. And now that the dog has the right amount of sleep, and it's like being overtired or woken up constantly, you know, by a smoke alarm, we would also be more reactive and frustrated. That what we discovered is a very calm, loving dog that has a lot of fear of needing to be in charge of it all. Can you talk a little bit about the fear element that causes dogs to bite, that causes dogs to react?
Yeah, so fear is the most common emotion that's fueling aggressive responses in dogs. They just feel threatened or not safe around a particular stimulus. It's the most common reason for dogs to display aggressive behavior. Now, there's other emotions involved that can influence aggressive behavior, of course. And so if we look at from an effective neuroscience lens in terms of Panksepp's work, you might have fear as the most common one, with anxiety sort of the cousin of that, as you had mentioned. And then you have rage or anger is actually one of the other underlying primal emotions or systems, which Panksepp referred to, which is why when we see those frustration-based scenarios come into play. So jumping back to the fear, if we restrict the dog's options to move away from something, right, or we restrict their options, so that's that fight flight, typical fight flight response, the dog chooses the fight to make that thing go away. But then when we restrict that option, we have the dog on a leash, or we have the dog being picked up by the owner and they can't get away from the scary thing, then you can also couple frustration in there because the dog's like, now I can't get away from this thing, so I'm frustrated.
There can be like a Venn diagram overlap.
Exactly. Yep. And there's often an overlap that it's not always just one thing. It can be sometimes just straight fear, but there's often what we're doing in our management scenarios is trying to restrict the dog from getting to that thing, of course, which is this obviously what we want to do. I'm not just saying just to let the dogs run around biting everybody, but it's if we restrict that, we often can have other things come into play. So the definition of frustration is not being able to accomplish a task. So frustration related aggression is usually I can't get to that thing or away from that thing, or you're preventing me, or you're holding me on leash, and I'm afraid of that thing, so you're restricting my flight option. So now I'm really going to have to respond intensely. So to get to your question about like why is it so intense sometimes, where other times it may not be, you'll often see more intensity when you see restrictions in their dog's options to move. So their agency, their choice and control in the environment, if it's restricted, the dog's going to be more intense. It's just like two guys at a bar. I use that as an example too. They really want to go at each other, but then somebody comes back and tries to hold the guy back, like grab their arms, and that guy's like, yeah, it goes even more because of the frustration there. Now, if I let that guy go accidentally, they're going to probably be punching harder, really going at it. So there's that. It's just like if the leash broke, we see that super intense response. Now, maybe the other person's like fearful of that guy, right? That same thing. Maybe they're responding in fear. The other guy is just responding in, you know, anger. And you might see a different response, but it might look very similar in intensity because of the restriction of movement. So let's say both guys are being held back. You know, you might see similar intensity once if they're let go. Hopefully one diffuses and runs away or something, but, you know, that's why we might see intensity. So, yeah, fear being the most common, rage or anger being the second probably. And then, you have other underlying reasons, of course, like pain, and other emotions that can come into play. But
I remember when I was a kid, I was just learning to drive. Choke chains were like still what everybody used to train a dog. And I had this wonderful dog. Her name was Shabby, and I'd grown up with her. And I was going somewhere with my mom. She left the dog on a leash. The leash got caught around the stick shift, and we used to have them or whatever. And she was trapped, and it was the most loving, slept on my bed, most gentle dog. But when I went to like get the leash free, she like bit my arm hard. And even then I understood she didn't mean it. She just, you know, was choking. You know, that's why I always tell people, get your dog comfortable with the muzzle. You and keep it in the back of your car. Like if they get in an accident or they get hurt, or you might find a dog on the street that's unconscious. I rescued a hawk once. I thought it was, you know, in a coma. Little did I know, 5 minutes later, it was staring me down in the backseat of my car, hissing. Like I didn't even think, you know, that would happen. But when animals are in pain, they use aggression to protect themselves. You know, I'd love you to talk on this a little too. I rescue a lot. I'm involved in rescue. I have a Havanese dog. I find a Havanese is a slightly more docile and easier dog to raise for certain people than many of the doodles. The doodles are so smart. One of the puppies, I forget, the door shut on its paw or something. It's 7 weeks old and it shrieked. And its mother, Peekaboo, my dog, ran over and like protected this shrieking dog. Turned, you know, she was okay. It was just the drama. And I had people there and I explained it that when they're little and they have those milk teeth, they are prey animals and they know it. So when they get hurt, they shriek for like an authority figure, a parent or person to like come because they feel grossly inhibited and terrified for their own safety. And it was fascinating because once that puppy stopped shrieking, Peekaboo was weaning them at the time. She's left the scene, growled at everybody, don't come near me, left the scene. But I, you know, that's another example of how dogs use different behavior and react to experiences according to their age, according to their breed, according to the situation, according to emotions. That, like you said, Panksepp made it clear that we're all mammals. We all share the different range of emotions. So age-wise, over the years, I've seen puppies at a very young age, we're talking 10 to 12 weeks, exhibit very aggressive behavior. It's, I call it idiopathic?
Idiopathic, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Aggression. Do you see that? Do you feel that's something you can resolve? Do you find it's comes from a lack of proper parental imprinting from the mother? Like, I know we've all seen it. It's out there. It's not, but it's a different sort of aggression because those milk teeth are still there. There are no hormones in the dog. It's very startling when you see it in such a young animal.
It can be startling. It's kind of like if we saw a child walking down the street with a machine gun in their hands, right?
Exactly.
It's like you don't expect it. You know, when you see a cute puppy, especially if it's a breed that's really cute, you're like, oh my gosh, what is going on here? So it can be shocking. But again, I go back to oftentimes it's a normal response to a particular situation, whether it's a physiological situation or an environmental condition. So probably the most common time I see that is when a puppy has just had poor initial developmental periods, meaning during the first 0 to 12 weeks of their life, they have issues with litter mates or their mom or something. Well, some of the other dogs that they're interacting with, can sometimes see that turn into overt aggression towards their litter mates or even towards their mom. Because of issues over resources. So lack of resources can be one. So not getting enough milk, not getting enough sustenance, whatever it is, not getting enough sleep, being in a stressful environment, all of those things can fuel the likelihood for that puppy to be really grumpy or competing over resources or has learned, I really need to compete over these resources or else I'm not going to survive. So that's the most classic case, and it's usually dog-directed aggression. Can be dog-to-human related as well. The second one is probably underlying medical issues. So parvo is very common where we're seeing, you know, changes in behavior. Yeah, Lyme. You know, to think of all the typical puppy afflictions. Can impact behavior, of course, because the puppy's not feeling well. So sometimes in those cases, fortunately, they're more direct ones to address because you address the health issue, usually you can start to see improvement in behavior. You might see long-standing issues with behavior over time, even if the health issue is resolved because of what the puppy's learned. But oftentimes that's a more straightforward case to address than like an intra-household dog-dog aggression case over resources. The health issues, the potential learning history. You might have in utero stress. So when the mom is pregnant, they're in a stressful situation. They might pass some of that genetics down to their puppies or some of that priming, I should say, for stressors in the environment. And that's actually been researched, interestingly enough.
Puppy mill dogs. Dogs
exactly. Any mom that's in a stressful environment, there's a potential risk of it being passed on. And it's more of you'll see the puppies be just more vigilant about the world that they're being brought into. Be like, I've got to get ready for everything because that's just been what I've sort of the hormones that have been passed down and the development in there. And I'm paraphrasing terribly because I'm certainly no expert in that particular regard.
Right. But you've read the studies.
So that's a big one. Yes. And then genetics is also, of course, another factor. So you might have genetic tendencies passed down into the puppies. So
a singleton puppy is more prone to show aggression. Dogs that aren't raised with a mother.
Well, I wouldn't say you're necessarily more prone. I would say we just have to be cautious because there could be obviously there's a lack of socialization or learning bite inhibition as well. But there's plenty of singleton pups out there that are beautiful, right? They're perfectly fine.
Well, if you're mindful.
Yeah.
Right.
So, of course, you do have to, again, consider the socialization aspect. How much social skills do they have with other dogs?
And we'll save that topic for another day if you'll come back because it's, you know, socialization.
It's a big one.
Imprinting. It's a big, big one.
Yeah.
And I always tell people it's the one stage you can't get back. Like you've got to get it.
You're going to be playing catch-up, right, if you miss that.
Well, I say it's an open funnel. It's an open funnel for those first couple of weeks, and it never closes completely, but it does invert once they, let's say, age out.
It can, so to speak. Yeah. And I think puppy cases, when you see overt aggression in a puppy, it's just I get that question a lot. It's like, what's the outcome? What should you do? And obviously, like every other case, it's dependent on the individual dog. So I err on the side of caution because yes, if you see a puppy displaying overt aggression, sometimes it can only be changed so much. So I do make my clients aware if they have that kind of puppy or if it's a breeder, we're making no guarantees or promises in the behavior change. We can do our best to help this pup and do everything we can, but it may not be that resolvable in some cases because maybe it is genetic. Maybe it's something that's going to be very difficult to modify. And as that puppy's going through adolescence and social maturity, if nothing's being done or if we're doing the wrong things, it's going to get much worse. So I always like, okay, let's approach this. We can work with this. Even if it's a puppy, like I've had puppies like scary, bite, hold, shake, not letting go, like can't pry it off the other dog kind of case. And you're like, oh gosh, this is really, really scary. But they end up actually doing quite well later on. So, and then of course, there's other dogs that don't do so well. They just continue to grow and then they get their adult teeth and it becomes more dangerous. And so,
now, when you say that, Mike, do you ever coach people virtually?
All the time. you can do any case. I've learned over the years now, in just the last few years through the pandemic, you can take just about any case and do it online now. Because aggression cases especially some of the things you do need to have the mechanical skills. But let's say, I think for me, it's a lot easier, air quotes, easier to work with an aggression case online than if I was to try to teach somebody agility or how to do the weave balls, right? Yes, you could technically learn it, but it's with aggression cases, the techniques, right? So like free shaping a behavior, you don't need to do that in most aggression cases. Right. Most aggression cases is just like the food has to happen somewhere, or the positive reinforcement or salient stimulus has to happen somewhere in that dog's, you know, when we're working around the trigger. But it doesn't have to be precise training where we're like free shaping the dog to get us a beer out of the fridge or something like that, right?
I want to kind of highlight something that I love about the work you do and the way you do it. Aggression over the decades has been addressed as a dominance issue. You have devoted your life to clarifying aggression is an emotion a dog uses to protect itself. I always say the number one thing your dog wants is to feel safe. And, you know, you extend that into aggression, that aggression happens when they're aroused and they don't feel safe. But so many people turn to celebrity trainers as though those trainers were highly skilled and highly educated and had all the right answer. Many people still turn to e-collars and prong collars as a way to dominate and correct a behavior. And while they're very effective in the exact moment, they can actually, negative reinforcement can have a lot of blowback, meaning the dog might bully up on a smaller child or another dog. And what I love about everything you do, it just keeps reminding people negative reinforcement is only going to intensify negative emotions that the dog's feeling. And what you're trying to do, and what I'm trying to do, you know, I'm working and I'm learning from you, and I studied aggression with Stanley Korn, is simply shift the dog's mindset into feeling more comfortable and more safe and less threatened. And I just want to influence how important that is for people to understand that. I just want to overemphasize how important that is about looking to someone like Mike and going and listening, that you're going to put your body in a positive headspace and look at working with your dog, not dominating or training or overpowering, that's not what it's about, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the takeaway message there is that we can suppress or stop any behavior if the punishment is heavy enough, right?
Exactly.
You can either physically actually stop it, or, you know, if you hit somebody with a bat over the head hard enough, they're going to stop coming at you.
Right.
And the same thing for dogs. We can technically suppress any behavior or stop any behavior in its tracks. The problem with that is that it never addresses the true underlying reason. So let's say we have a dog that's in pain, right? And we're trying to touch them on their collar because they have, we're trying to maybe clip a leash on or something. And then they snap at us, but we don't know that they have a cervical issue at the neck and they're in pain. And so they don't want us touching over there because they don't want it. And then the dog snaps at us. And then we have somebody that like wants to punish the dog. Oh, how dare you snap at me? Like, I'm the one that feeds you and gives you all your treats and stuff. And so then the dog responds negatively, and then the person responds negatively and tries to suppress that. They might say, no, don't do that, or punish the dog. And then, of course, that might work in the instance where the dog's like fearful enough of that stimulus or worried enough about that punishment that they stop. So it never actually, though, fixes the issue. The dog still has that pain, still has the next issue, still doesn't feel comfortable when people approach. So you might see the suppressed behavior for a while. Like the dog's like, all right, I guess I won't air snap, but it still hurts. And all it takes is that one time where it hurts enough, the dog's like, you know what? I've really had enough. The only way for me to really make this person go away is to escalate. So let me bite harder. Let me charge harder. Let me intensify my attack. And that's the most obvious example. But there's other scenarios where it may not be pain. It could be like a fear response or some other negative association. And if we continue to suppress that.
I was going to say, a lot of small dogs, when you approach them quickly, especially when they're young, but even older dogs, when you approach them like that, they quickly perceive, you know, an attack because you're coming at them like an eagle or a predator would come at them. And they back up in order to say, you're overwhelming me, and people chase them or corner them or snatch them. And like you said, when they're young or when it's happening in the beginning, they're inhibited. But over time, they just are like, stop, don't do that. And the only way they have to communicate that, since posturing doesn't work, is to bite them or snap at them. So there are a lot of reasons a dog might bite you, and it doesn't just happen. It's generally a buildup. Dogs can't say, listen, I have a hot spot under my neck, or my joints are achy, or I feel feverish. We have to be so mindful of them. And when you speak of like dogs not wanting people to touch their collar, I think of all the cases I do with little puppies, with tiny dog breeds, where the dogs are backing up because the people are moving at them swiftly. They're in a hurry. They got to walk the dog or take them out to pee. And they come at them with outstretched arms and with their adrenaline pumping and walking straight into a dog's personal space. And, you know, I can envision it. I can see the dog initially backing up or trying to hide in a closet or going under a bed, and the person, you know, using their hands to grab. And one of my little kitschy sayings is hands are for giving, not for grabbing. When you grab a dog, they feel like they're caught by a predator. They can't process, it's my mom and she's normally loving, or it's my dad and we usually play. It's just in the moment when we grab them, it feels like a talon of a hawk or the jaws of a coyote. And the dog routinely backs up, tries to hide, avoids the leash, gets, you know, reactive, bites the leash, pulls on the leash. And over time, when they're not understood, they snap. They air bite or they snap. Or they'll snap a child because the child seems less threatening than an adult. And when you really look at behavior as a response to their environment, and behavior as a sign of arousal, and look at the way the dog's acting from the dog's perspective. And like you said, it's... what's the word you used? It's advantageous.
Adaptive is one
word. Adaptive begins with an A. Thank you, Michael. All right, let me start that again. If you look at behavior as not good or bad, as simply an adaptive response to a given set of, issues that are happening in the moment, then I think as a person, or even a person you're teaching, they become less threatened. They want to understand. Everybody wants to have a great relationship with their dog. And once you help them understand, this is just your dog's way of reacting to that situation, and here's what you can do to make it easier and help them understand it, people feel good about the relationship. Nobody wants to jerk their dog and shock them into submission. And I always say, I love my dogs and I love my clients. Like, they wouldn't come to me if they didn't want to develop a better relationship with their dog.
You know, I think the big takeaway is that when we work to understand our dogs more, like why they behave a certain way, instead of just observing what they do all the time, like, and then putting our own interpretations of it, right? We need to really dig deep into why a dog is doing what they're doing. And with aggression, it's so crucial. It's really the secret sauce to understanding aggression, is first understand, you know, why the dog is doing this. It's often because they're feeling a certain way about something. And when we understand that, then we can empathize to their needs, and we can change our own behavior. We can change the environment. We can manage things. We can modify things without getting into the dog's, you know, using force or using punishment or doing anything that's more restrictive or negative for the dog, right? Once we understand those things, that's how we help these dogs, right?
Yeah, and then the question isn't why do dogs bite people, but what can I do to help my dog feel safe? Michael, thank you so much. I hope you'll come back on the show again. Thank you, everyone who's listening. This has just been a great look at dog aggression and how we can really influence our dogs to help them feel safe and happy.
I appreciate it. It's been fun chatting. And if anybody wants to learn more, they can go over to aggressivedog.com. That's where it's the one portal I point everybody to if they're interested in the podcast or the course or webinars or articles. It has everything on there. Conference. It's all listed on aggressivedog.com. So head on over there if you want to learn more.
And I always say to, everything you're doing, not only like, his materials, which I know you will, but also share them because we want to make the world a better place one dog at a time. Thank you again, Michael. I'll see you out there in all various ways.
Thank you, Sarah.
Okay. Bye-bye.